Today on Against the Grain, is Donald Trump a fascist? Or a right-wing populist? What about Marine Le Pen of the far-right National Front, who received the support of a third of French voters in the last presidential election? I'm Sasha Lilly. Historian Federico Finkelstein will speak with me about what we mean by the terms fascist and populist, not as abstractions, but looking at history. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Is the U.S. in danger of ascendant fascism? Many on the left have asked that question, and various pundits like Chris Hedges have warned of the specter of a fascist takeover. But there's been very little discussion of what fascism is and in what historical context it has gained power. Similarly, there's been insufficient discussion about the nature of right-wing populism and its relationship to fascism. In From Fascism to Populism in History, Federico Finkelstein argues that fascism and populism should not just be discussed as abstract categories, but need to be situated historically. And they need to be examined not only in the most famous European examples, but in the Americas, North and South. He's professor of history at the New School for Social Research, and his other books include The Ideological Origins of the Dirty War. Federico, the term fascism has been thrown around casually a lot in recent years. What are the crucial differences between fascism and right-wing populism in a nutshell?
Yes, in a nutshell, fascism is a form of dictatorship that thrives in violence. And when I say violence, that this is not a mild form of violence, but actually ends in genocide, and in the most famous case, Nazism, it ended in the Holocaust. Populism, on the other hand, is an authoritarian version of democracy with high levels of, rhetorical violence, but compared with fascism, and only compared with fascism, then low levels of violence.
When these terms are discussed in the United States, the reference points tend to be in Europe. Certainly Nazism, as you just said, but also populism, the emergence in recent decades of populism, especially right-wing populism in Europe. Why would you argue that we should not just look at populism and fascism through these European lenses?
Well, because the problem is that then there is no historical background to what's going on currently in the U.S., which is that for the first time you have populism in power. I mean, of course, in American history as well as in European history, there have been many instances of populist in the opposition, and yet not in power, not in terms of what we are seeing currently in the U.S., which is an administration attempting to become a populist regime. They are already in power, and they are trying to become something very different to what has been, American government in the past. Now, if you want a historical background to that, then you have to move into Latin American history, where this happened basically many, many decades ago, and it's going on. It has been going on again and again. But basically, populism emerged as a power regime in Latin America after 1945. So basically, there are a couple of things that we can learn from comparing with Europe, but not in terms of, Trumpism, which was xenophobic populism in the opposition, becoming a regime, which is what we are seeing now.
Well, we'll talk a lot more about populism, but let me just start with fascism, because just taking it historically makes sense to start there. You write that fascism is a modern counter-revolutionary formation that was ultranationalist, anti-liberal, and anti-Marxist. Fascism, in short, was not a mere reactionary position. So I wonder if you could tell us what has driven fascism as a political orientation and locate it historically for us.
Well, fascism is not merely reactionary, because It looks to the past, and it wants to, as everybody knows, fascism even talk about, you know, the golden times of the past, including the Crusades, including the Roman Empire, and so on and so forth. But in fact, what fascism was putting forward was a new way of, let's say, reformulating modernity, and reformulating modernity in a fashion which was extremely violent, extremely authoritarian, and actually a way of doing politics which has not existed before. So they did not want to return only to the past, but rather they wanted to change the present and create a very new future. I mean, that is the weird sense in which they were counter-revolutionaries insofar as they were against, you know, the modern revolutions, the Enlightenment, I mean, both the liberal and socialist revolutions, but they were also revolutionary in the particular sense of creating something new, which, of course, for me, as a citizen, is something horrible. Now, as an historian, I have to recognize that fact, that they were attempting to do something different from the past. So they were not merely reactionaries in that particular sense.
Fascism took place in a particular historical and social context. It also, you write, was transnational, so not just bounded by national boundaries. Describe the circumstances in broad brushstrokes in which fascism emerged.
Yes, well, there is a long history and a short history. The long history is that the background of fascism was the ideological movement against the Enlightenment, really well described by historian Sever Sternhell in his book on the Anti-Enlightenment, that basically at the time of the Enlightenment and at the time in which the first notions of democracy, of modern democracy, were born, there was a moment of reaction against that, which was this movement that eventually morph into fascism. And that morphing was important because, I mean, and in a way, this is a short history. So the extreme right existed for a long time, but what was new with the emergence of fascism was that in fascism you have the, let's say, the recognition that even when they liked the past, they couldn't go back into the past. That even, for example, when, you know, when in the case of Hitler, they liked the imperial times, I mean, you know, the Second Reich, they wanted to create a Third Reich, which was going to be different. So in a way, fascism represents a new attempt, at least, in the interwar years, it was the newest attempt to really leave democracy behind and create something new, which was rooted in this rejection of the modern revolutions of the 19th century, or even the 18th century, from the French Revolution to the American Revolution, and more recently, in terms of fascism, the Socialist Revolution. So fascism was against all those revolutions, and yet it did not want to return to the times of the king, to the monarchy, but rather create a new political system which was going to be, and it was actually, revolutionary, but also totalitarian and extremely violent. And as a power regime, this happened in the famous cases of Italy and Germany, later Spain. But fascism actually was a rejection of democracy that happened worldwide. And different people across the world, from China to Argentina to Brazil to Egypt, identify with this global movement for dictatorship, for racism, and against democracy.
In the places where fascism had the most support and the most strength, what was going on in those societies on the left? Was it reacting to the strength of social movements in any way?
That's a really good question, and it's actually a point. I mean, yes. I mean, the fact that the left was advancing was a matter of great concern for the people that eventually became the fascists. But of course, the causes of fascism are multicausal. I mean, there is generally the sense that fascism happened because of crisis, economic crisis. But that really well explains, you know, to some extent, the German case. But fascism emerged in Italy before the crack of 29, much before. And basically, fascism was the result of many things. A key issue was, of course, the First World War, with its incredible unleashing of violence. And basically, fascism was originally funded by people that came back from the trenches, war veterans, that basically they have some of their first political experiences were in their attempt to translate their experience in the trenches to political life. That's why some historians talk about the fascism as a militarization of politics. So they have learned war, and then when they return to their own countries, they try to translate that war experience into politics. And that explains also the incredible violence that fascism unleash against those that they dislike and they regard as enemies. Fascism then, of course, identified people on the left with those defending the values that fascism was against.
By and large, who tended to be in the ranks of fascism, and what was the relationship of elites to fascist movements?
Yes, originally it was, many people thought, now we know wrongly, that fascism was the mere instrument of very powerful people in economic terms and very powerful people in political terms. Now we know that in fact, it was much more complicated than that, and fascism, in a way, was the instrument of no one. I mean, they had a clear project according to which totalitarian politics were even more important than economic considerations. That doesn't mean, of course, that fascism wanted to reform, to change the capitalist system. In fact, they wanted to regulate it and, in a way, make it work with their project of a society in which dictatorship prevailed and civil liberties were non-existent. Now, that worked with capitalism, but so other systems work with capitalism.
You argue that one of the things that's distinct about fascism, distinct about populism, is that they have periods of time where, if one's looking over the last century, where one was ascendant and then the other was. And you point out that there haven't been fascist regimes in the late 20th century. I wanted to ask you, what's the difference between fascism and dictatorship, thinking about, say, a country like your country, Argentina, which in the 1970s had a dictatorship of the generals?
Yes, I mean, let me put it this way. There is no fascism without dictatorship, but it can be dictatorship without fascism. I mean, there are many types of dictatorships. In the case of my country, in Argentina during the Dirty War, where thousands of people were killed by the Argentine state just for thinking differently or being conceived as enemies of the state, basically what I show in my previous book, which is called The Ideological Origins of the Dirty War, is that in that particular case, there was a connection with fascism, that basically the ideology that was the main provider of meaning to the perpetrators, to the killers of the dictatorship, was a fascist ideology as it was conceived in the long 20th century in Argentina. So I started my work, that book, with a history of fascism in the classical years of the 1920s and 1930s, and then I explained how that ideology had an important legacy in triggering the dirty war in Argentina. Now, in other cases, you can have dictatorships, and in Latin America, we had different Cold War dictatorships that did not have necessarily a fascist background or a fascist situation. So, and even now, in North Korea, for example, it's clear that there they have a dictatorship which is not fascist at all. It's a totalitarian, but it's not fascist. So basically, that's the difference between fascism and dictatorship. Now, with populism, is as we already touched on that point in the beginning of our conversation, that populism cannot exist without democracy. Basically, that is probably one of the key differences between populism and fascism. Then, of course, when populism engages in dictatorship, then probably we might be talking about either dictatorship or fascism, but not necessarily populism. So these categories are not static. I mean, in history, what you have is different situations in which something that is populist can become fascist, and vice versa.
Is one component in separating fascism and dictatorship that you have mass movement from below? Is that a component that might distinguish a fascist movement from a simply top-down dictatorship?
Yes, that you have a lot of activity from below, but in many dictatorships, eventually, they have the ability to create consensus and not only rely on repression. So most dictatorships, or actually all dictatorships, combine repression with consensus building. Now, at different moments in dictatorship, you have consensus, but it's true that, I mean, that your point, I think, is well taken, that in fascism, what you have also is a massive movement from the beginning. Now, that will be an interesting distinction between fascism and other types of dictatorship, because fascism, I wouldn't say this is an irony, but it's a very peculiar way in which fascism emerges. That is to say, fascism works with democracy and destroys it from within. So fascism emerges as a movement or a party within a particular democracy and eventually destroys it and establishes a dictatorship. Whereas in the most typical dictatorship, what you have is a coup d'etat without a movement, and you have a dictatorship which eventually tries to reach different spheres from above and below. So that is a difference, I think.
Historian Federico Finkelstein is my guest. We're talking about his book, From Fascism to Populism in History. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So let's switch now to talk about populism. You write in your book that, quote, on a global scale, populism is not a pathology of democracy, but a political form that thrives in democracies that are particularly unequal, that is, in places where the income gap has increased and legitimacy of democratic representation has decreased. That, of course, sums up our time. Why is inequality so important to populism?
Well, because inequality is a problem for every political system, and especially in democracies. That is to say that if people feel that they are not in a place which they feel they deserve, they tend to vote for other political representatives or other political options. So what you have in that context, when people do not feel they are okay, to put it just in colloquial terms, if people feel that they are not okay, then it has been historically the case that they look for other options. And here what you have with populism is candidates telling them, you are not okay because there are people above that are against you, and I will now be with you against those elites. And this is basically the message.
And you are saying, just to be clear, that this is a central thing that distinguishes populism and fascism, is that populism, as much as it may have authoritarian rhetoric, is not about completely destroying democracy, whereas fascism is about precisely that.
Yes, I will say that populism tends to destroy democracy slowly, and eventually, in most historical cases, is voted out of power. Now, in populism, you have this idea that basically the things are not okay because the elites have been ruling against the people, and you have candidates that tell the people, "I am the people. I am like you. I am, in a way, I am you, but also I am better than you because I know exactly what you want better than you actually recognize it or even think about it." So basically, these candidates represent themselves as messengers of the people. And famously, actually, to talk about the present, you have the current American president saying, for those that cannot speak, I will speak, and so on and so forth. And then the difference between that and fascism is that the fascists basically say the same. The difference is that they don't say, vote for me. Eventually, they say, you need only to believe in this because this is the way things will be. Meaning, I am the dictator. Whereas in populism, what you have is, let's say, that dictatorial language without dictatorial practice. Now, eventually, of course, that is in the opposition. When populism becomes a regime in history, I mean, by analyzing all these historical cases that I analyze in the book, basically, I can tell you that in populism, what you have is this idea when populism becomes a regime, or when populism reaches power, that there is a tendency to move from this rhetorical argument that basically the leader is the people and the leader is better than the people and so on and so forth, to also anti-democratic practices, but without eliminating democracy altogether. Because think about this. If you have a president, for example, that says that whatever he does or whatever she does is what the people want, and of course, people that voted for that person will initially agree with that, then what about those that do not agree with that? Then, you know, within the populist logic, those, people that do not agree will be then against what the people want. Now, what is the democratic legitimacy of a people that are against the people, or a sector of the population that are against the wishes of the people? And thereby, then you have already a kind of proof of how the democratic quality of a particular nation has decreased.
Does populism have an affinity because of that sort of focus on the nation or a community toward xenophobia?
Well, it depends, because the point is that if you allow me to give you a very brief historical itinerary.
Sure.
I will say this. I mean, populism was a movement in the opposition in this country as well as in Russia and other places before the emergence of fascism. We are talking about the end of the 19th century, even before. We are talking about the early 20th century. And populism then was a form of opposition which basically opposed the people to the elites. It never reached power. It was not as politically important as other places. It is with fascism that this notion then, now in the form of dictatorship, become, you know, all overpowering in a way, and become really important in world politics. Now, after 1945, the fascists had lost. And then the question is, what happened to these ideas? I mean, because now you have, after 1945, a new bipolar war of the victors. That is to say, communism on one side and Western democracies or the American hegemony on the other side. Well, what happens is that there are many people that had been fascists before or had identified with that said option between socialism and liberalism that fascism had offered them. Now they realize that in the new world, it will be very problematic politically to be a fascist and reach power. So these people then, their idea is that then they will try to combine fascist elements with democratic ones. They win elections, especially in Latin America, in countries like Brazil and Argentina, but later, relatively later then, in Bolivia and Venezuela. And then these people create, in my view, what is now modern populism. Now, that populism that idea of, let's say, an authoritarian version of democracy that is neither liberal nor socialist, that idea can be taken rightward or leftward. I mean, and history shows us that there are different populism on the right and the left, which, in my view, should never be conflated. Because when you conflate them, you create something that doesn't exist in history. They are almost antithetical, often, these populists on the left and populists on the right. Now, and the main distinction is the one that you signal in your question, in my view. Because populists on the right, their idea of the people, and I think we should return to this issue of what is the people for the populists, but at this time, let me say that their idea of the people is an ethnic idea, is an idea or a racial idea. So on the right, you have the tendency to conceive the people of a nation in racial terms, and thereby the outcome of that is populism as a xenophobic movement. Then on the left, generally you don't have this. You don't have the idea of the people as a racial element, but rather the people as those that identify with the leader as the political choice. So the notion of the people then is political identity on the left and racial identity on the right. And that, thereby, I think, yes, for populism of the right, xenophobia is a key element.
Talk a bit more about the distinction between populism of the left and right. Those terms get thrown around pretty glibly in the United States case. It's often presented that Bernie Sanders represented the populism of the left, whether that's accurate or not. Trump, populism of the right, two sides of the same coin. The United States may not be the best case to sort of explore these differences, but like if you were to look at someone like Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, how strong an affinity is there politically between a figure like him and someone like Trump? I mean, because for a lot of people, that seems, it's hard to sort of wrap one's head around it.
Yes, well, I mean, first let me say that I think the description of Bernie Sanders as a populist is highly inaccurate in my view.
Sure.
Because, I mean, here in the U.S. there is the tendency to confuse what is popular politics or even the, you know, defending the policies or the needs of popular sectors with populism as such. So it's a conflation that is totally unwarranted in historical terms. I mean, a key element in populism is the idea of the messianic leader who knows better than the people what they want, who speaks for them because, as Trump said, they are silent, and who actually thinks that they shouldn't speak insofar as he's the true interpreter of the will of the people. Now, I see nothing of that in Sanders. So I think, you know, it's a confusion between what is, you know, defending popular sectors with populism, which is speaking in the name of the people against the elites to actually elevate a leader that eventually will rule for all. So, I mean, I don't think, you know, I think it's a problem in the conceptualization. And I think it is a problem that actually discloses the political desires of those making that conflation. Because basically, generally, it is presented as a way to somehow present the status quo as a sort of ideal, of ideal politics. And I think, you know, I think we are talking about two very different cases here when we talk about Sanders and Trump. And I think there are so many distinctions. And the first one, by the way, is that I don't see any populist situation in Sanders.
Sure. Well, let's take the example then of Hugo Chavez and Trump, obviously in quite different national contexts. But nonetheless, should this catch-all category of populism apply to them both? Very different kinds of politics.
I think it does, because basically populism, I mean, if we can, you know, as you know from the book, but probably many listeners do not know this, that basically this is a book that argues against definitions which in many ways cannot account for what actually happened in different historical processes. And basically my argument is that populism is a specific phenomenon in history that emerges out of fascism and yet reformulates democracy in an authoritarian manner and is anti-liberal. And these are some elements that I have seen in all these cases. And basically presents two ideas which are central. The first is that those supporting a particular candidate, those are the real people. The others then are either idiots that ignore what the people really want, or even worse, traitors to the nation. This is the populist idea of the people. The idea is that the people that are with the populists, those are the real people, or the people as a whole, and those against do not represent the people, or do, even if they are the people, ignore that they are voting against the people. Now, that is a first moment in, you know, in the populist concoction. The second moment is that there is the first moment in which the notion of the people as all the citizens is suddenly reduced to those that like a particular candidate. I mean, you can see this in Trump, for example, when all this talk about make America great again, because you wonder, sure. Okay, but probably is Trump referring to the period before, you know, actual civil rights in America. So obviously for some people that was not great at all. But then we know that Trump is not talking for that people, because in a way those are, at the end of the day, not the real people as his, you know, voters conceive the real people. The people that basically they identify with are Trump voters that are against, you know, a more diverse notion of the American people. So the first translation in populism is this idea that the people, in fact, are not all the citizens of this country or all the people living in the country, but rather those defending whatever the leader says. So that's one. So this kind of almost religious faith in a leader. The second element is that, in fact, in practice, those people are not even the people, because the actual people in a particular sense, and this is the second moment in which the people are reduced, is the translation of that reduced people to the actual leader, because in fact the leader is the people. Eventually the leader is asking to be not a representative of the people, but asking actually people to vote for him in order for power to be delegated onto him, and then he can decide for the people, because he's the impersonation of the people. Okay, then when you move to situations such as Chavez, without the racism, although there were instances in Chavez also, important instances of anti-Semitism, but then I would say racism is not as predominant, and then what you have is similar conceptions with very different politics. But the idea, let me put it this way, there is a populist idea of how politics work. According to this idea, people that vote for the politics are the people, and people that vote against are actually what people like Chavez will say, anti-people, or as Trump will say, the enemies of the people.
Historian Federico Finkelstein is my guest. We'll return with him in just a moment. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Today we're discussing the book From Fascism to Populism. It's published by the University of California Press, and its author is Federico Finkelstein. He is professor of history at the New School for Social Research. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, Federico, what then you have been discussing the differences and the similarities between left and right-wing populism. How does right-wing populism relate to the elite?
Well, that's a super interesting question because, I mean, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter where the particular social or class background of the leader, because the leader relies on the fiction that he is the people. He knows better than the people what they want and so on and so forth. So, I mean, the leader can be a member of the elite, as it has been many, many times the case, or not. But once in power, and this is, an interesting thing that you cannot learn from opposition movements in Europe, but rather from the Latin American experience, is that once in power, then we may ask, if the basic element or one of the basic elements in populism is this denunciation of the elites in the name of the people, then what happens when they are in power? Because, in fact, one way or the other, they are the new elites. Either they are older elites in a new position, or they are people that were not on the elite, but now they are, insofar as they have power. So then, how can populism sustain itself without the ideal place of being in the opposition, denouncing everything people do not like as, part of the conspiracy of elites against the people? This is a key issue, a key question, I think. Now, what is very peculiar is that the way they answer the question is, in fact, not in a rational way, by acknowledging this new situation in which they have power, but rather saying, yes, we are in power, but the real powers, I mean, be it the deep state, the European Union, in some cases, imperialism or whatever other enemy is created, the real power is more powerful than us. So we are still, even if we are in power, we are still against those elites that are against the people. Now, in that sense, when you think about politics in the U.S. at the current moment, it's easier to understand why this person that actually is very powerful, I mean, he's the president of the United States, is constantly denouncing the elites, which for him are more powerful than him. And this is also a way to explain his many failures. And indeed, this is not new in populism. This is actually how populism works in power. It still denounces elites as being more powerful than the leader.
But does populism, right-wing populism, when in power, upend the status quo? Clearly, fascism does.
Yes. Well, it depends. I mean, again, the fact that, what I can tell you is what happened before. I certainly, as an historian, we are terrible in predicting the future. That's not our job, and I don't know exactly what is going to happen. And in that situation, I am in the same position as every other citizen. Now, what I can tell you is what happened before. And I think, sadly, from my own understanding of these different trends in the past, from a democratic perspective, I was never hopeful about the new administration. I mean, you could read in the media all this talk about how this president will become presidential, about how this or other general now is the adult in the room, and so on and so forth. Now, historically, if we pay attention to previous cases, that almost never was the case. Because you have people reaching power with this recipe of authoritarianism, demonization, and populism on the right, I mean, racism being a central element of that, then why this person will change their political logic? And I think it's almost, I don't see many analytical bases for seeing this change, and certainly I do not see this, you know, historical precedent for this. I mean, this is my way of saying that probably what we will see in the Trump administration is continuous attempts to downplay democratic institutions, to elevate racism and demonization of the other as key elements of politics, and so on and so forth.
But it certainly doesn't seem like he's challenging any consolidation of wealth or power with elites. I mean, at some point he talked about the bankers, and that seems to be one of the tropes of populism. But in power, all of those things seem, you know, at best untouched. And in fact, the strength of these different elites is only made stronger.
Yes, well, I mean, first, generally, I will say, in the history of populism, as in fascism, these were not, never basically anti-capitalist movements. They were always attempts, in a way, they were, I mean, ironically, they were kind of reformist movements, in the sense that, I mean, vis-a-vis capitalism, in the sense that they wanted, I mean, in the classic cases of both fascism and populism, they wanted to, to somehow combine a capitalist economy with their different political imperatives. Fascism, of course, put forward war and genocide as a key element in those imperatives. And in populism, they are much more humble in this regard. Basically, they want a system in which they can sustain themselves in power. Now, then there are different types of populism. And in fact, history here shows us a lot, because in the 1990s, at the time of the Washington Consensus in Latin America, we had many populist cases of neoliberal populists. So this relation between, actually a relation that we are witnessing right now in America, this relation between, you know, populism power and neoliberalism is not new at all.
Can you explain more what you mean by neoliberal populism? Give us some examples. Because one of the things that we have seen is that although people may not term it neoliberalism, there has been in mainstream discourse the counterposing of neoliberal democracy against populism. And those populists over there are anti-democracy, and here we are defending democracy. So you're saying that those distinctions are not hard and fast, and perhaps that it also takes neoliberalism off the hook.
Well, I will say this, that these easy made distinctions ignore the historical record. Because you have people, speaking in the name of the people, presenting others as the enemy, and the same things that basically someone like Trump does. We have that experience in Latin America under the presidencies of, you know, Carlos Menem in Argentina, Fernando Collor de Mello in Brazil, Fujimori in Peru, and many others. And more recently in Italy, you have Silvio Berlusconi also under the same aegis of neoliberalism. What I mean by that is that you have these authoritarian attempts to downplay democracy in a populist key, which basically were coupled with austerity measures and neoliberal economics. You have that. Now, neoliberalism as a way of understanding how economies should work is not allergic to other forms. In fact, as you know, neoliberalism was also at the center of dirty war dictatorships in Latin America, such as the ones of Pinochet and the ones of the junta in Argentina. So neoliberalism can work with liberal democracy, it can easily work with populists, and certainly with dictators. Questions could be whether Trump is a neoliberal populist. And my view of this is that what is new about Trump is that, yes, he's a neoliberal populist with sometimes nationalist and autarkic undertones, which also, you know, the generals in Latin America had, but also a kind of overpowering racism for him that is totally new. So in a way, you have all these combinations in this amalgamation that is Trump: populism, neoliberalism, racism.
Sure. I'm speaking with Federico Finkelstein. He is professor of history at the New School for Social Research, and we're talking about his book, From Fascism to Populism in History. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You argue in the book, as we mentioned earlier in the program, that in thinking about populism in the United States, it would be useful to look at the history of populism on a global scale and look at the history of Latin America. Do you see any continuity between the forms that populism has taken, which obviously takes place all over the world, but has taken in the Americas and the histories of settler colonialism. Is there any connection that you see there?
Well, I mean, look, I mean, there was, you know, when I came to this country in 2001, I heard many times that the politics which people like me study for the rest of the world, fascism, populism, even dictatorship, were so unnatural in a way to America that there was no connection, that this was a different universe. And, well, we are clearly seeing now that this is not the case at all, that in fact, you know, the United States is the world leader in populism at the time, and is the world leader on a type of extreme populism that is, and this is a major distinction between, you know, American populism and other types in Latin America, that is, that it includes racism as a key element in its, let's say, in its talk, in its ideology, and its political imperatives. Now, in Latin America, you don't see that. In fact, this is one of the peculiar moments, I mean, that we are witnessing right now. That is that in Latin America, populism emerges after 45 as both a reformulation of fascism, but also as a rejection of the most, let's say, undemocratic features of fascism, which, of course, were racism, war, and political violence. I mean, people like Juan Domingo Perón in Argentina, he was a fascist before, but he realized that fascism was basically that these things that fascism had before 1945 were not going to be legitimate in the new Cold War that was emerging. And basically, they left fascism behind. You know, the remnants of fascism were these new ingredients of the authoritarian democracy that they conceived. And yet, fascism was left behind. So fascism is that authoritarian form of democracy that attempts to somehow bridge the gap between fascism and liberalism, but also, I mean, thereby is a hybrid between democracy and dictatorship. Now, that's the beginning of modern populism after 1945. What is the peculiar moment that we are witnessing is that what we see in Trumpism, and we see the same in countries like, I mean, in movements like AFD in Germany, you know, the Marine Le Pen in France, and other racists and populists in the Netherlands, Austria, and other places, is that, in a way, they are going back to fascism or to the racism of the fascists that the first populists actually left behind. So it's a kind of, in a way, I don't think it is a full circle, but rather a return to something that, you know, that actually was not in the origins of populism. In fact, it was the opposite of that. So they are trying now to return populism to some fascist elements that early populists like Perón actually rejected.
So would you characterize someone like Marine Le Pen of the National Front in France as still populist or quasi-fascist?
Well, she is from a movement that was neo-fascist, and at one point in history, particularly in the 1980s, 1970s to 1980s, decided to try to engage more with democracy. The result of that is that we have this right-wing populism rather than neo-fascism. So at this moment, yes, I will define her as another example of this extreme right-wing populism, xenophobic and racist, that Trump also represents.
Well, one of the fears beyond the general fear of whether fascism is ascendant is that these right-wing populist movements might allied into fascism. Looking historically, how common has that been? You have mentioned earlier that
yes,
the early 20th century was characterized by fascism. Post-1945, elements that had been fascist embraced populism. Could we expect the reverse to happen? Or is that less common?
We certainly could expect it, but I have to tell you that historically, this has been very uncommon. So there are some examples, which I provide in my book, such as in the 1970s, people on the extreme right of Peronism in Argentina that eventually became neo-fascist and started, you know, assassinating political opponents, and actually the count is, you know, less than 1,000 people that were killed between 2 years in Argentina. And that is a moment in which, of course, demonization of the other leads to the elimination of the other. And that is a moment in which, clearly, populism turns to fascism. One example. Then, more recent examples, not as extreme, I think we are seeing in the cases of Erdogan in Turkey or Nicolás Maduro in Venezuela, in which, one key element of populism is that is, it claims the legitimacy of the votes. You know, a key argument is, I have been voted. And we see this, of course, in the U.S. The U.S., of course, is a weird case in the sense that populists generally are voted by political majorities. And here we have a populist that actually was not voted by the majority, but won the Electoral College. But leaving that aside, I will say that there are, these two cases in Turkey and Venezuela now, they seem to, because they cannot, for whatever reason, for example, in Venezuela, they cannot easily win elections, they are leaving behind some democratic procedures that actually proved really useful for populists before. And then, if there are not free elections, and then are we still talking about populism? And in my view, in Turkey and Venezuela, what we are seeing or we are witnessing is the threshold in which populism moves to dictatorship.
But that's,
they are in that kind of border.
But that's populism to dictatorship, not populism to fascism, right?
That's a really good point. That's a really good point. For populism to fascism, I would say there are really few examples. The most famous one, because to some extent it was sort of successful in terms of what they wanted, was the case of this AAA, the Argentine Anti-Communist Alliance, that, this eventually some of these people became soldiers in the so-called dirty war, but in fact they were people that were collaborating eventually with that dictatorship. So democracy was destroyed, and they became kind of the killing hands of the dictatorship. But again, this is extremely uncommon.
Yeah.
In most cases, the most cases, what is the most regular outcome of populist regimes basically can be summed up in two options. The more recently, the most common one is that they are voted out of power. This has been the case in many places. Then the other option is what happened in Argentina, with the first government of Perón, or what more recently happened in places like Thailand, which is a coup d'etat. And basically what you have is a dictatorship against the populists. To put it differently, an anti-populist dictatorship.
Right. So the question then is raised, and looking at historically how fascism and populism have tended not to coexist at the same time in any significant way, that you have periods where fascism was ascendant and then came to power and populism. Why do you think that is? Do you believe that one sort of fulfills the need of the other, channels the need of the other?
I think, this is a really good question. What happened in history is that people that were populists became fascists, and eventually people that also had been fascists, became part of populism. Now, what we are witnessing now, I think in the U.S., but also probably we will see a similar coalition or a coalition in Austria, is a sort of coalition between populists and fascists or neo-fascists. And I think in terms, not necessarily in terms of the administration, but in terms of how the leader in the U.S. conceive of his people and his, basically his hesitation to denounce people like neo-Nazis and the KKK, as we have seen after the horrible events in Virginia. Basically, what that shows is that he sees himself as the leader of a coalition of populists and populists, conservatives, but also neo-fascists. So basically what you have at the moment then is a president of a coalition which includes neo-fascists.
Well, let me end with this question. I realize you're a historian and not a soothsayer, but looking back at least, how has the left effectively challenged right-wing populism? Are there any lessons that can be drawn?
I think, both the history of fascism and as well as the history of populism shows that that there are important things to defend in a democracy, and defending those things basically makes life very difficult for these authoritarian leaders and regimes. The fact that they are in power doesn't mean that they are all powerful, and I think from continuously voting for candidates that, you know, that do not agree with them, as well as you know, trying to defend the independence of the judiciary as well as of the independent press. And last but not least, participating in the public sphere, manifesting against authoritarian measures proves to be all of these issues prove to be important barriers towards the consecration of a populist regime or a fascist regime. And history shows that in many cases, these authoritarian projects were unsuccessful precisely because of this, that the participation in public life of people that were against these authoritarian projects.
Well, yeah, so, I mean, one of the questions is a distinction between populism and fascism is the kind of raw violence that fascists will mete out in the streets. But if you're talking about a coalition between right-wing populism and people who are outright fascists, to what degree do you think the streets themselves become an important place for the left to hold against the threat of fascists?
I think expressing dissident opinions in the street is of paramount importance in downplaying the reach of authoritarian projects. And I think in the U.S., particularly after the election of Donald Trump, we saw a lot of that, and probably that, you know, that provided some barriers to what otherwise could have been a more authoritarian direction. I mean, if you see, for example, the initial moments in fascist dictatorships, I mean, things happen all of a sudden, and power is taken from most citizens, you know, in a matter of weeks, if not days. And I think this type of leadership is always attempted to the extent of popular opposition to them. And I think, you know, that is a basic issue, that remaining at home, not voting, not expressing oneself on the streets are only benefiting those authoritarian leaders.
I've been speaking with Federico Finkelstein. He is author of From Fascism to Populism in History. That's published by the University of California Press. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. He teaches history at the New School for Social Research, and his other books include The Ideological Origins of the Dirty War. Federico, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you so much.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.